So recently I'm looking to buy a car, and I thought to myself, there's got to be a better way. I mean, that old game of cat and mouse at the dealership, going to the manager, coming back, it's so stressful. I'm breaking out in hives. Not a pretty sight. But then my friend told me about a new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. At TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car you're looking for in your area, so you know when you're getting a great price. Because at TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate. And you just take that savings certificate to the TrueCar certified dealer on the certificate, so you don't need to worry about the hassle and anxiety of the old way to buy a car. And TrueCar users save an average of $3,000 off the sticker price. $3,000. Imagine what you can do with that. A little vacation would be nice, right? So seriously, if you're ready to buy a car, why wouldn't you go to TrueCar.com? Negotiation-free, guaranteed savings, a hassle-free experience, and a TrueCar certified dealer that is committed to a new and better way to buy a car. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. Save some money. Take a vacation. Bring some lotion. You don't want to get a sunburn.
Warriors, come out to play. Warriors, come out to play.
One gang could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen.
This week on the podcast, we have Brian Kilmeade, host of Fox and Friends on Fox News and Kilmeade and Friends, his nationally syndicated radio show on the Fox News Network. Brian and I are talking about his book, George Washington's Secret Six, about a secret spy ring based in Long Island, where Brian is from. Really fascinating book, cool conversation. And we're just talking about whatever's going on in the news. Brian and I have a kind of fun relationship, and he's given me suits in the past and shirts. So we'll see in this episode what I can get out of him. Hope you enjoy it. Really cool conversation with Brian. He's a great guy. And check me out doing stand-up this coming Saturday, April 26th. I'm going to be at the Bridge Street Live Theater in Collinsville, Connecticut for one night exclusive engagement. Everybody's had a great time there, so looking forward to going back. May 1st through the 3rd, I'm going to be at the Comedy Castle in Royal Oak, Michigan. May 15th to the 17th at Gotham Comedy Club in New York City. And May 29th to the 31st. At the West Palm Beach Improv in West Palm Beach, Florida. And keep following the podcast, tell your friends about it, and check me out on Facebook and Twitter.
We got the streets, suckers! Can you dig it?
All right, here we are. Welcoming back. Very rare to have a repeat guest. I must like you. My friend, Brian Kilmeade from Fox and Friends on Fox News and Kilmeade and Friends. Or my nickname for you is BK, the Broiler. BK, the Broiler Burger King.
Right. I've heard that before. You could also look at it, the fact that I'm a repeat guest and I like you.
that
could be both.
That is true. There were a lot of negotiations involved in this one. There was a certain length of limo that had to be provided.
Right. And also, I had to leave you a voicemail and you had to call me back. That's as far as I know.
By the way, I got to thank you right up top. The last time we did this, we joked about your watch and the suits and everything. And he's over the you have clothed me for like four lifetimes.
But did the other stuff fit?
It fits great.
Does
I got four like high-end custom-made suits. Like the shirts fit. We're like, it's very, you're going to be freaked out about this. But you and I think maybe brothers from another mother.
Very
same
similar.
Body type, except in a certain area.
Right. How mad are you that you're married? This is a time you can go actually get girls.
I know, exactly.
Right? And now you're married. See, or it's going steady.
Well, going steady would be the thing. And so I got suits, I got shirts. So now that I'm on this podcast, I need some cufflinks and ties. If you could kind of.
I actually have both.
No,
yeah, I'm serious. Because here's the thing, one of the great things, and there's a lot of great things about Fox, is one of the first days I was there, I'll never forget, they bring you down to clothing. And I'm like, wow, we got clothes? I'm like, how do they know my size? And they left. I go, what are you talking about? They open up just pieces of cloth. They go, all you do is you pick out a swatch and we make the suit for you. And they literally make the suit for you because they want the best. One thing about Fox, about presentation.
Right.
And with women, it's a lot harder because they've got to separate all the women. They all can't look alike. There's like a dozen anchors on every day. Men, there's no way we're going to look alike between the ties, the shirts, and the suits. And they showed you clothing. I could not believe it.
Yeah.
Because I had two suits at the time. And I thought, I'm like, this could last me through the 90s.
It was 97. They were lime green and lapels. Now, do they fit you for the hairpiece or is that your own?
My own.
Okay. Yeah. I was curious because it's really good.
Thank you. It looks real.
Hey, when are we going to go on the road together and do something?
I don't even think we're past this interview. Should we do that after the interview?
No, we should go on. Well, we're going to have dinner with the wives.
Right, absolutely.
Remember I called you on a Friday at home?
No, but you never go out to dinner with somebody funnier than you.
No, I'm not funnier than you. You're super funny. We rode together a couple weeks ago.
See, I'm funny for a news guy. You're funny for funny guys.
No, you're funny stand-up. Tell one of the jokes that you used to do in your act.
This is what I do. What I did is I wanted to do stand-up because I want to get better at this.
And this was in L.A.? You were doing it in L.A.?
Well, I started in New York, and I'm an organized person. You're from the business world. I have to have a structure. When am I going to get stand-up? What am I going to need to write material? I can't just sit down in a yellow pad and wing it. I didn't think I knew the structure, and I was right. So I took a class.
Right.
And I knew that class at the end, like many people, is going to end up in a performance.
Right.
So I said, what do you do a lot that's unorthodox? I go, well, I'm always shopping. I always went shopping with my father, always went shopping with my grandfather, and certain products jump out at me. For example, cereal, Mueslix. Who would ever buy something named Mueslix? Sure, it's good for you. But who buys cereal? Kids buy cereal. What kid's going to say, Mom, not the Sugar Tiger cereal again, not the Dancing Leprechaun. Can I have Mueslix like the other kids? Sure, I enjoy. So, and then I built on from that. And it was only fun. Then I say, the other thing that makes no sense are products. Who buys this stuff? Powdered milk? I'm like all of you. I enjoy a tall glass of powdered milk on a hot summer day. But why Alba? You know? Can I have some Alba?
So do you miss stand-up at all?
Yeah, I do. I miss the challenge, but it's so much harder than people think because you do one and you think it should be over when you realize that's just the foundation. You got to go up, and you guys go up two times a day, five times a week, nine people in the audience, seven comics. It's a Monday, Tuesday night.
It's funny. Somebody the other day said to me, you're a comic. That's easy, right? You just I'm like, no, it's kind of not.
Actually, I think it's just the opposite. The average American is in awe of stand-up comedians.
Well, tell the women out there because I'm trying to, you know what I'm saying?
Right. You just want an audience because you have a woman. This is taping.
I do. That's right. I do have a woman. And we are going to go out to dinner with the wives sometime.
Isn't this the free conversation before the interview?
All right. So I want to talk to you. You have a great book out, which we talked about before, George Washington's Secret Six. It's doing great. It's very high on the Amazon
list. It's been for 19 weeks, has been ranked in the New York Times list.
Right. Okay. And you've been around the country doing a book tour with it.
Not really.
Yes. Well, you have. No, just say you have. Why can't you just play along a little bit?
Because I want to try to tell you that it's not been a national tour. Greg Gutfeld, that's a national tour.
Yeah, but
I haven't even been to Texas yet. The Texas people love me, but my book company said, I have a better idea. Let's not tell anybody. Let's see if they find it.
You just had a great outing in Maryland. You do not know how to spin things positive. How does your wife live with you? You're the most negative person.
I'm at work a lot. So
you just had a Bethesda, Maryland.
Good. Fredericksburg, Virginia, huge. And these people are so into it. Washington was born there. They understand history. So I was able to bring something that they didn't really know much about. So they were thrilled.
Right. And you're doing Q&As.
Yeah.
And you're getting questions about the Jets.
Right. It's so good to work on something for 15 years with Don Yeager, George Washington's Secret Six. Mm. And people go, hey, what's wrong with the Jets? I'm like, thanks. I don't remember what chapter the Jets were in. Nothing about Rex Ryan helping out the colonists or the Minutemen.
Before we get to the book, and I want to talk about it in detail with you, because it's some great...
Every sentence starts before we get to the book with you.
Because we're going to get to that in the last 3 minutes, I promise. Right. It'll be the best 3 minutes of the day. Al-Qaeda, the day we're taping this, Al-Qaeda apparently, they had like a little picnic.
Right.
And we apparently didn't know about it until it was posted on YouTube.
Exactly.
What's going on? Why did the NSA, the NSA knows what you texted your wife today, apparently, but they don't know this.
Well, here's the thing. You're not kidding. This is the number two guy in full-length color televising his outing,
right,
where Al-Qaeda gets together and he wants everyone to know he's number two. Now, there was a time, and I credit President Obama with this, he took President Bush's drone program with Hellfire missiles, which he said, get missiles onto these drones, and it worked. But President Obama did an unbelievable job blowing up these people in Pakistan. And then he made an announcement. I'm stopping.
Because of political pressure. That was the problem. Yeah.
No, political pressure. I mean, George Bush wrote the book on political pressure.
I understand.
Gitmo. So, but political pressure, he was getting nothing at home.
Well,
he's getting very
look. This isn't a partisan conversation. I'm not defending Bush. I agree with you that the drones are good, and I'm disgruntled that they stopped the program. But
I'll build on this because here they are in one central place. They learn not to never be in one central place again,
right.
And they are. And guess where else they are? They are standing out in Syria now, actually in the same area, as if like they colored in a certain section of Syria and said, "Let's meet here." Now, Congressman Rogers, who used to work in the FBI, said to the administration, "Hey, listen. I know you want bomb in Syria. We got guys that can handle this."
Mm.
And basically, he can't get anybody in the administration on the phone. Now, I understand if they don't take Paul Mercurio's call or Brian Kilmeade's, but he's chairman of the Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, that's a call.
Can you at least get him somebody? Well, can you text him back?
Obama's busy with Michelle's fitness program. He's doing push-ups.
Yeah, and by the way, he's trying to get the minimum wage raise.
Right.
And by the way, women, Republicans hate women. We all know that.
Yeah.
How many women protesters do you have to walk through to get into News Corp today? Because they get 8 cents less than men, for the most part. I'm not even sure what the protest is. 8 cents.
Well, 8 cents. You add that up. That's
16.
That's a lot of makeup, and we're gonna get letters. Tell me what you're doing. But the point is that with this drone program being pulled, I think it's been the political pressure that he's gotten that he's caved to, which I think is now going to bite him in the ass on this go around because Al Qaeda's feeling. I'm hearing, and from what I'm reading, that since 9/11, they've never been stronger. They certainly took a hit, but they've come back, and they've come back strong.
Absolutely.
And that there are new devices that they're coming up with to get through security at airports and things like that. So it feels to me like it's not just the drone program being pulled back by the Obama administration, which I think came through political pressure. And I'm not saying just people from the right. I just think he's been getting it.
Well, no, he's not getting it from the right. I don't know anybody outside of Rand Paul that thinks the drone program is bad.
Right.
If he's getting it, it's from the ultra left, because I know a lot of moderates, Carl Levin and others, are like, this is pretty freaking good.
Mm.
And Senator Schumer, pretty liberal, everyone likes it because he knows the threat to us, it's Americans, not Democrats or Republicans, is Al-Qaeda. They're actually getting together. They're doing everything except wearing glow-in-the-dark team uniforms.
Well, exactly. It was sort of like, it was literally, I was looking for like a wide shot for it to be sponsored by Subway Sandwich.
Exactly.
It was like a literally open field.
It's a three-camera shoot. And it was like an episode of Seinfeld.
And then
you tossed a commercial in the middle of it.
I have the solution to this problem with women in the workplace.
Which is?
Let's strap some angry women on drones and drop them into Al-Qaeda. They'll slap them around.
Oh, yeah. Women would definitely take control. Absolutely. Yeah, women, the President of the United States really is on the right topic. Today he's in Western Pennsylvania talking about job training. Don't train anybody for jobs. Let's talk about possibly training people for jobs. And let's bring Biden. Could you possibly fan out? I mean, do you have to travel together? I mean, come on. Can someone handle the Ukraine?
Oh my God.
Whole thing, it's not helpful that you're invading another country. No kidding.
Right.
Especially the country that's being invaded.
Oh, Ukraine's gone. I said this to you on your radio show.
You can't give up Ukraine?
We shouldn't. But the problem is we're dealing with Putin as though he's a politician, and he's not.
Thank you.
Cousin Bobby, the mobster in Rhode Island. You have to deal with a mobster with mobster mentality.
But he actually looks like a mobster.
Well, he does.
You're right. I mean, it's not like, he looks like such a nice guy. No, he doesn't.
You have a feeling if you go to his office, there's a button, and he pushes a button, and a wall slides back, and it's just cash. Cash and a wall.
I thought
wall.
You meant, you got to say cats.
Cats.
Oh, yeah. It's unbelievable.
So how do we – so what's the solution for Al-Qaeda in terms of
bomb them.
Right. But my concern is what's going to happen is that we're going to have another incident to embolden this administration to start that program again.
Absolutely.
And why isn't –
But, Paul, I'm going to finish your sentence. Mm. We just talked about this on Kilmeade & Friends. Is that – do you remember we didn't really understand the threat of Al-Qaeda? In 98, we took a shot at them through some Tomahawk missiles, and then we heard about them. We never thought they were going to hit here. Bush takes over 7 months in. He's like, we got to handle this Al-Qaeda thing. But for 8 years, we really did nothing to them. We sent a Tomahawk missile, as we mentioned. Everyone thought it was wag the dog because Bill Clinton was in all this political pressure. It wasn't. He actually took a decent shot at them in retrospect. But that was it. but he let all these plots thicken. All the hijackers were here. When Bush took over, this thing was on fire, and he wasn't cognizant of it.
Right.
Now we know.
Right.
Now all this stuff is happening. I got Bin Laden, kicked a few guys, tried a few guys, put them in jail forever. We're okay. There hasn't been an explosion in a while since Boston. It's been a year. Plus, that guy wasn't Al-Qaeda.
Right.
He was an Islamic extremist. All this is festering. In Syria, they're able to do total operations, get weapons, some even from the West, who hate Assad so much in Syria. And they're able to get some other weapons because we're giving them to the Free Syrian Army, who were saying, wait a second, Al-Qaeda just took my stuff when I nodded off.
Mm.
So now they have weapons, they're armed, and now they're fanning off through Africa. And we're letting them grow,
right.
Letting them grow like a planter's.
And why do you think that is?
Because they know our system is allowing it. They know that President Obama made a speech a year ago saying we're pulling back. Only in certain circumstances we're going to do this.
And why do you think
he's pulling back? The drone strikes are going to stop.
And I think for me, what's laughable is that people want an omelet, but they don't want to see it get made, right? Like, so, okay, it's like, go make this terrorism problem go away. But do it in a diplomatic way. And if you can't do it in a diplomatic way, using the word diplomatic in the context of war, have it be war, but not really bad war where people are getting bombed. Like, send a guy in to kill him is okay, but don't send a machine in to kill
him. Special forces.
And I don't understand that mentality. I don't understand the argument. You're not a little bit pregnant in life. You're going to go kill somebody, kill him. I don't care how you do it.
Well, de Blasio's the same way. This is the number one terror target, and he just stopped our Muslim infiltration program. That's my name for it. But Ray Kelly did it to a great way. Didn't violate anybody's rights.
For people don't know, in New York, there was a surveillance program targeted to the Muslim community in New York based on, obviously the history with Muslims and attacks in this country. And as you just mentioned, the current mayor is pulling back on that.
It's a disaster. It was successful, but he says we're not going to do that. And what he's going to do is allow these things to fester, which you do a lot of the times. People are intimidated by these radicals amongst them. Look at the Zarniyevs, the Boston bombers.
Right.
They scared the other guys in the mosque. They go, this guy's a little crazy for us, right? They were screaming at him, you're too Western. They're like, can you get out?
Yeah.
So can you imagine we had a guy in Boston? Boston doesn't do this.
Right.
Imagine we had a guy there, this guy, without a Red Sox hat on, then kind of blended in a little bit, and just said, wow, we got to watch this guy.
Right.
Let's do a run background check. Oh, wow, he's in the Caucasus region to get away?
Yeah.
Is he vacationing?
Yeah.
He's vacationing with the Chechenian rebels. I think there's a little bit of an issue there. It's not known as a hot spot.
No, exactly. Real quick, and then we're going to get to the book.
Right. Take your time.
You were a sports guy for years and still are. Follow it closely. NCAA, as of today, comes out with a rule that the student athletes are going to get to eat.
Yeah, they're going to get to eat.
Because this all came about, it really came to light with Shabazz Napier saying they go to bed hungry because generally in these schools, after 7 o'clock, a lot of these kids are on meal plans. After 7 o'clock, the cafeteria is shut down. And a lot of these schools also, they're not allowed to bring food back to the room. And the NCAA, with their $11 billion contract, is gracious enough to say,
annually.
Talk about a dinosaur of an organization.
It's true.
Why? Well, what's going on?
Well, this guy, Shabazz Napier, he's going to get drafted. He's going to be fine. He's going to be an MVP, barring a career-ending injury, and I'm sure he has an insurance policy. I'm worried about the good guys.
Yeah.
The guys, if you're able to play at UConn, you're excellent. You're the best in your CYO. You're the best in high school.
Right.
You're unbelievable. But you don't have a future because only 30 guys will be drafted, 15 will be eventually cut.
Right.
Most of them are going to be journeymen.
Right.
And sometimes second-round picks, about a third of them. So they go to Italy, Israel, whatever, and they go to themselves, making $100,000 tops. And how long is this going to last?
Right.
And plus, they got everybody back in home front, a lot of them from urban environments. They don't have it.
Right.
This is what I would like to see happen. I would love to see these guys get from the NCAA only for those who attract viewers and people in the seats. Not soccer players like me.
But who's going to make that determination?
Not softball. No. It's very easy. It's basketball and it's football.
Oh, I thought you were talking about on the basketball team specific individuals.
No. I'm saying you get basketball and football, the revenue generating sports, some areas of baseball.
Right.
And you get a portion of that revenue goes ahead for these players. And you can't give superstars more money. There's got to be some type across the board.
Yeah, but you know what the argument – it's a valid point. It's smart, but you know what the argument is going to be. The softball team and the men's lacrosse team are going to be like, wait a minute, we want a piece of the pie.
No, they're not. and life is like, no, they're not. Because if I go into roller derby, I can't expect the same salary as if I went and it was the best of roller derby and soccer. Is a,
I've seen
a
you
example.
In short roller derby shorts, and you can expect a lot of money if you
Thank
want
you
to do that.
Thank you very much. I do have a nice butt because I do a lot of squats. But if I choose a sport that's not revenue producing outside maybe four colleges, that's the lot I pay in life.
Well, this ties into Northwestern's football team deciding
I
to
don't
union.
Want a union. You can't have a players union.
Why?
Because then you get lawyers in negotiating contracts with high school kids who we have no idea how they're going to pan out. You got to keep it centrally.
But you have no idea how if we're talking about a freshman coming out of college, how he's going to pan out in a professional sport. You have no idea. There is.
I'm going on the auspices. Nobody goes pro.
No. Listen to me. Right now, the system is set up. Right, it's one and done. Right, so you could be a freshman. You're 18, maybe 19 years old.
You're not one and done.
Okay.
You got to go the four-year player. One and done is rare unless you fail out.
Okay, so you feel like that student athletes should play the entire 4 years before they go?
No. This is what I'm going to say. Allison just walked in, Mansfield, our producer.
Okay.
Here's the deal.
I have coffee for
you. I don't have the whole thing worked out, but essentially I say this. Basketball and football generates billions of dollars. And the argument that Lou Holtz, who's an outstanding football coach, yelled at me about and said, we supply the revenue for the entire athletic department, the field hockey, the non-revenue. There's enough revenue there to still supply to the others. However, the players, and I'm not talking about me, the players are the only thing that's indispensable about that deal.
Totally agree.
And it's not the coaches. It's not the university.
Right.
But yet, they can't be going to Notre Dame and not be students. Then they become a AAA. No one goes to see proportionally AAA football.
Right.
They'll go to see college. I want to see, you chose Alabama, you chose USC. Let's see what you got.
So you want to see the piece of the pie divvied up to the sports that drive the revenue to the...
Given to the players after they graduate or complete 4 years. And maybe if they matriculate 6 credits and they want to do that, they could still get it. I'm talking about $50,000. You put that aside, there's still plenty left for your field hockey, for your softball, and for your chess
team. No, I think it's a great idea, but what it speaks to for me in 2014, that a young 19-year-old, 18-year-old kid in Napier has to come out and say, I don't get to eat after 7 o'clock. For Mark Emmert, the head of the NCAA, to go, oh, okay, this probably looks bad. We should let kids eat. Like, really? Like, literally, up until today, if I were a coach and I wanted to buy you cream cheese for your bagel— For $1.29, that would be a violation.
Absolutely.
So what I'm saying is it's draconian. It mm-hmm. hasn't changed. It's not changing significantly. This isn't a great step forward today.
Isn't.
What's broken about this mechanism? Is it just that the money is so blinding these guys?
No. I think that, number one, they got to do it in an organized way. I think this whole union thing passing is something the NCAA does not want. And they realize they now have to act. It's not so much they're being greedy. They're like, how do we do it? So let's just hope they get it right.
All right. Listen, let's talk about why we came here to talk today and about my act. No. About your book, George Washington's Secret Six. We talked about it before, but I want to get into some details on it because one of the things in reading the book, and I did read the Cliff Notes. I did read the book, is it's very character driven. Although, in general, the concept is that there was a secret spy ring set based in Long Island that was critical and crucial to gathering information to defeat the British. But it's a very character driven book, and there are really fascinating characters in here. Tell people how very quickly, just a synopsis for the listeners who may not have heard before. How you came up with this idea to write this book? What was the genesis for it?
Well, I saw, here's an example. I was very simple. On 25A, which is a major thoroughfare historically on Long Island that goes right through, they were painting a line on the road. And that line washes away. And I said, what are you doing? Well, we're commemorating 200 years since George Washington came to Long Island mm-hmm. to thank those who helped him in the war, including his spies. And I said, what spies? And then they started talking to me about the spy ring on Long Island, which I'm fascinated by history anyway and couldn't believe I didn't know it. So essentially, on and off, we were studying this. Me and a friend of mine, another soccer player, we were like, can you believe this? We were like, is this all true? How come this movie hasn't been done? Then The Patriot comes out and National Treasure comes out. I go, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
Mel Gibson got that movie sold and it's good, but I have 4 times the story here.
Right.
Then another book comes out and we're like, wow, we're going to lose this thing. Let's try to get a script together and get a movie. One thing leads to another. I had the opportunity to write 2 other books that were successful, and between everything that happens in your life, put it off. finally, I teamed with Don Yeager. He wants me to do a sports book. Don Yeager wrote 27 sports books, and he's a Sports Illustrated writer. And I go, Don, thanks, flattered. Not interested in book. I got to get this movie done. And he said, why not a book? I go, because it's been done. He goes, let me see. I literally gave him handwritten notes this thick in an old beat-up folder. Mm-hmm. And I told him the story, and I told him into sections. I go, this is what I'm developing. So he said, if we could come up with new information, let's do the book. So we approached it like a news story, just like I had Fox said to me, find out something new about this. So we did it, and we approached it the way he would a Sports Illustrated article and I would a Fox News story. And we were able to get all these people together, and we realized they don't even agree on a lot of stuff. Mm. Get them together in the same room. Let's forge. Let's get new information. And we did. And we got more stuff, and then we built on it. We really feel like, after looking at Bill O'Reilly's template of killing Lincoln, killing Jesus, and everything he's done, we told it, we think, in a compelling way mm-hmm. that got people interested.
One of the things that's really fascinating is that the war, obviously, it's a war, any war, but that war in particular is transformative for people. And there are people, characters in the book that come from very different walks of life that come together for this cause, some as soldiers, some as spies in the spy ring, some as counter spies that the British had in place. And, you know, there's Abraham Woodhull, okay, in chapter four, who is, you describe him, a jolly young man turned soldier who ran eagerly into the welcoming arms of the American cause, right? He comes from a fairly well-to-do family.
Farmer.
Right? And so, but like not farmer that we think of poor, like, you know, wealthy. Well,
they owned a lot of the area.
Right. And explain, just describe that character a little bit, because I was fascinated sort of about what this war did to him and how he contributed.
He had it. I mean, after the Battle of Brooklyn, we lost badly, almost got annihilated. The British just...
And a lot of people moved out of the city at that point. You talk
they
about...
They had it. Yeah, I mean, the city was as bad as it got. There were no rules. Hookers, drinking. The soldiers were totally undisciplined. They're thousands of miles from home. And they said, what are we afraid of these guys for? We destroyed them. They ran rather than fight, which was not really true. They ran in order to fight another day. They were almost destroyed by the number one superpower in the world.
Right.
So they pull back, and they use Long Island as its grocery store. Because by the time supplies got from Britain there, they would have starved to death. So they went back, and they just stole from farmers. They stole from grocery stores. They paid them almost nothing. Mm-hmm. So anybody who was indifferent about the war changed. Because they're like, screw these guys. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just treating us like crap, like we're second-class citizens. That's why I moved to America, because
right.
I was treated like crap.
Right.
I don't want to pay taxes that I shouldn't have, the Stamp Act, the tea tax. I didn't want that to begin with, but I was willing to suck it up just to be left alone.
Right.
But now you're taking my stuff.
Right.
Now, Woodhull watched. Everywhere he looked, there was Brits all around him. They were all over his farm.
Mm-hmm.
So he reminds me of Steve Buscemi. He was thin. He was always at a complaint. You got to read his letters to Washington. It's like, hey, listen, I never was made to be an intellectual guy.
Right.
This is the best I can do. I'm sure you could have done better with somebody else. But then he would not only give information, then give Washington advice. Washington would write back, listen, don't give me advice. Give me information. Right? And you got to give me a favor. A lot of times by the time I get my your stuff, we know it already. So you little Vince Lombardi, thanks for risking your life, but give me some stuff I can use. So they finally get a guy into the city, which was another guy who knew from a famous family, Robert Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
He opens up a grocery store.
Right.
And now what you're going to find through this book is everybody has cover stories, just like any spy novel.
Right.
They have a cover story. Only they live this.
Right.
Why would Abraham Woodhull have to go to the city? Well, he needs supplies. Where do you get them? Just like today, the city. And what do you got to do? You got to bring them back. What if there was a note jammed in some of that wheat, some of that grain that you had? And it turns out the notes has a lot to do with the purchases. We found their original ledgers from 1770 and 1790 where they would keep track of their purchases, and they happened to correspond with the letters in which we recovered.
Okay, so the purchases we're talking about are the purchases that the Brits were making?
No, that Abraham Woodhull would make for his farm. They need some supplies. They need some seed. They need some grain.
But then he would bring those supplies back with information through Townsend.
Yeah.
And tell people, Townsend was, you describe him in chapter six of the book, as bookish, mild-mannered, fit none of the molds. Was not a braggart, had no sumptuous taste and mercenary tendencies. And yet, he's in the thick of it in a critical part of the spot.
He got pulled into it. They took over his house.
Right.
And his brothers were the charismatic, good-looking guys. And he was like, hey, pay attention to my brothers and my sisters. I just want to get through life.
Right.
Just leave me alone.
Right.
But he's smart.
Right.
Smart guy. And as soon as Woodhull asked him, at first he said no. And the more he got asked, they saw he took over his house. They saw he was treating his father. He got correspondence with his brother. Originally, his brother was fighting with the loyalists. And after a while, he's like, listen, I just met Benjamin. Literally, I met Benjamin Franklin over in France. I'm changed. I'm with these guys. At the same time, Robert goes, I'm in. His dad goes to the city. We're not sure he even told his dad he was doing this. Dad, very prominent guy. And he went to the city and he opened up a grocery store, which they already had a store there. And he had a reason to be there. And guess who's there? The British. Guess who? That's their headquarters. And guess what he does? Listen. He starts winning them over by being trustworthy. Mm. They like seeing him. He likes selling stuff
to
them.
They start telling him. So they get loose around them. And, they start
and then he has a better idea. He goes, I'm going to go to Rivington's Gazette. That's a loyalist newspaper. I'll be a reporter. So, Paul, they were able to go up and report on interview the officers for the story. He'd write the story, keep the good intelligence for himself, go there, write in invisible ink messages to Washington, give it back, original intelligence. He also knew the shipping industry. He could tell a ship coming in, what they had, what their cargo looked like, the size of the ship, and what it was capable of. He was able to give Washington a lot of that information. Rivington would eventually, at first we thought he didn't know he hired a spy. But then it became clear the owner of Rivington's Press became a spy. He ended up writing his newspaper. He also had a coffee shop. So that was like a bar.
But this was over time, from what I understand. That
it was three and a half years.
In terms of once these guys are in it, I mean, did you find from any of your research, like, there are any moments where, like, this is getting too dusty
absolutely.
For me?
Absolutely. The whole time they're quitting. In fact, after Benedict Arnold was outed, he came into the city with his, like, on a mission to find out who outed him. And they went under. And they basically, and it looks like 355, the woman of the ring got captured and we believe killed. And they just said, we're out.
That you call the lady, right?
Yeah, call the lady, 355. Yeah. Right. In the paperback, we have four ideas of who it could be.
Yeah.
But the other guys, we know exactly who they are. So Robert Townsend went under and said, not only that, I quit. He didn't like – he actually tried to get his cousin involved. His cousin screwed up, got captured by the Americans, and then Washington had to get him out and said, you idiot, how could you let this guy in? He doesn't know anything. And basically Culper Jr. has a little bit of pride and goes, I'm out. Mm-hmm. That's his handle, Culper Jr. Mm-hmm. Culpepper was where Washington grew up. Culper is short for Culpepper.
Right.
So Culper Sr. was Woodhull. Culper Jr. was Townsend. He's like, we're done. Now Washington needs him. And he basically said, all right, I'm done with the ring. Thanks, whatever. So they were footnotes in history. And then Washington needs him because he knows the French are in and he knows they're coming to Rhode Island. He needs to know if the British know the French are in coming to Rhode Island, because if they were able to stop the French before they can disembark, they could neutralize and maybe dispirit them to not helping us. So he goes, activate it. Activate the ring. Find out. And if Culper Jr. won't do it, Culper Sr., I need you into the city and you got to do it. But Culper Jr. finally at the last minute says, all right, I'm on to one more mission. Gets in there, finds out for sure that they do know. And the British were on the march to head him off in Rhode Island. Washington was able to stage a phony hit on New York. Keeps the British home. They thought they're going to get, thought they were going to lose New York with the skeleton crew.
Decoy
move. There was a fake move, and they all came back. The French were able to disembark and able to get their feet underneath them. Lafayette ends up interacting with Washington, and together they would plot the ultimate victory. Last Battle of Yorktown was designed at Mount Vernon.
You mentioned, and it's just so fascinating, on page 120, Louis the 16th's Secret War, and you talk about as early as 1776, the fictitious, if I'm mispronouncing this, correct me, Rodriguez, Hortelez, and Company Trading House had smuggled French money and provisions into the colonies, right? So, in other words, the French were both on the surface and behind the scenes as part of the spying, helping the Americans and the American spying. Explain that a little bit.
Well, here's to keep in mind, too, the French were at war with us and Britain in the U.S., which was not the U.S. in the 1750s, the French-Indian War.
Right.
That's where Washington learned to spy, from the British and from the Indians.
Right.
So when they've come in, they're like, hey, I would love a shot at the British, but you need to show me you can win. So until the Battle of Saratoga, they were not convinced that the U.S. had the future United States of America had a shot. Continental Army could be successful. After they saw that, they said, we're in. And the British were in a lot of trouble because they were dispirited. They'd been there too long. And they got the sense that they could never quite defeat this enemy they could not see, because we had time. We're not going anywhere.
Right.
They had to go back sooner or later, right?
Right.
So that's what got them in. So the French were first helping us with supplies, and then they were helping us with actual troops. They took a long time to get in. But talk about diplomacy. Adams and Benjamin Franklin worked them. Need you. We got to do it. We make history, blah, blah, blah.
Did they help with the spy ring?
No, but they did interact with the spy ring. They used some of the intelligence. Well, they got the Battle of Yorktown. They got the naval codes, the British naval codes, to the French Navy prior to the Battle of Yorktown. I didn't know this, but they'd be able to signal each other what their maneuvers would be through flashing. and he got their codes. So the British, the French were able to anticipate the British moves without even knowing. The British never even knew it. But Rivington got it, somehow maybe won over the trust of a British officer, we presume, got it to Washington. Washington goes, oops, I don't have a Navy. They do. Got him the codes, and they did it.
Tell people in this, who in the spy ring sort of was the guy that was able to kind of keep the spy ring together when people were, you know, obviously Washington's at the top, but who is sort of the central figure?
Benjamin Talmadge.
Yeah.
Benjamin Talmadge grew up on Long Island, and he won the trust of Washington. He wrote a 77-page book about what it was like being next to Washington during the war. In his last days, his kid's like, Dad, you've had an extraordinary life. Please write it down. And he goes, all right, take this down. This is what it was like being on his shoulder at the end, in the beginning, when I first heard gunfire. And this is what I did. He only wrote cryptically about the spy ring. Why? Because he's an honorable guy, and they said, we will help you. You can never tell anyone who we are. And it ended up being apparent that Washington found out about Austin Rowe. He stayed in Austin Rowe's tavern in 1790. He knew about Woodhull. Woodhull literally was 5 miles away.
Oh, wow.
And the Woodhull place. That makes sense. Caleb Brewster was out. Caleb Brewster is like a guy that evidently a badass guy like Dwayne The Rock Johnson without the Hawaiian features.
Like to, you, basically.
Yeah, very similar. And I, again, like Dwayne The Rock when he wrestled, no shirt on during the interview. And he, with six guys, was the guy who rowed across, take on the British.
Right.
He goes, on the way back, let's harass the British Navy. And he used to do that.
It's just a little psychotic.
Yeah, with a little cannon, yeah.
But, you know, growing up, you always, like, we all had, like, a group of friends. And yeah. There was always, like, there was the wise ass, there was the smart one. And you always wanted to have that psychotic beast friend who would be the guy that would punch the first guy
right.
in the face at the bar.
Like your Satch. You know, Satch exactly. in the Bowery Boys.
Exactly.
So, yeah, so that's it. So he made up. So we don't think he ever met Townsend.
Yeah.
And obviously never met 355. We don't know. We know he met Rivington. His grandson, George Washington's grandson, said they met. But they kept everything private. But he intimated about this ring. And then later the Talmadge interacting with the ring. All the letters would come
well,
to surface.
The great thing about the book is it's really character-driven. And it's like you cannot stop reading it. And I think you mentioned the movie and you know, writing it as a movie. And then you see the turn. And I want to talk about that in a second on AMC. But there's another fascinating character on the other side of this, you know, Major John Andre, who... You know, it's interesting because when you think of fighting and you think of war and you think of people on either side, you don't think of these sort of effete individuals and, you know, that are sort of from the upper crust of society. And here's John Andre, father born in Geneva, mother in Paris, educated in Geneva, very upper crust. And he finds himself a counter spy for the British. And I just think, again, sort of there's a saying, it's fun to watch ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances or vice versa. And that's what a lot of this is in these characters. Talk about Andre a little bit.
Andre was a charismatic guy who wowed all the ladies, had a great time doing it. When he went down south to fight and help out, you notice the intelligence kind of leveled off. That's why we believe 355 was close to him
okay,
in some way.
Back up. In other words, he's with the British. He's
in New York City.
Right. Goes
and
south.
He was a guy who was all over this thing. Mm-hmm. He would show up at the Townsend House with Simcoe. Simcoe took over the Townsend House. He was a badass captain, mm-hmm. major.
In the British Army.
In the British Army. Mm-hmm. He took over the Townsend House. And you see Andre show up at the Townsend House. It's almost so convenient. It's like All My Children, where all these guys interact, but I don't even know they're interacting. Simcoe was the guy who went after Woodhull because they thought Woodhull was up to something. They beat up Woodhull's dad. So Simcoe goes back to Townsend. Simcoe gets caught and gets released. And Andre, the whole time, even though he's on the other side, he's winning people over. I was like, yeah, Andre, he's an officer, but he's a great guy. And when he was actually hanged, Talmadge oversaw it. Kind of convinced Washington, like, why are you hanging him? You really going to hang him? He goes, yeah, the only way we won't hang him is if they turn over Benedict Arnold. Give us Benedict Arnold, and we won't hang him. They go, we can't give him back. They go, okay, we're going to hang him. They're like, you're not going to hang him. They hung him. And people were actually crying
right.
on our side because of it. He couldn't believe it. We have his sketches in the book, and we just put in one of them. Because he was sitting in a guardhouse that still exists today at Stone, and he was just sketching stuff. Like, okay, I'm waiting for that deal to get done. He goes, hey, by the way, we got some officers of yours. You might want to exchange me for them. Yeah, you know where I am. Come back in. And by the end, he ends up dying. They're like, wow, he gets hanged. It's unbelievable. He goes, I can't believe you're doing this. He goes, can you shoot me? The firing squad is how you usually kill officers. He's like, no, we're going to hang you. It's like, are you hanging me? And guess who got hanged? Nathan Hale. And guess who Talmadge roomed with in college? Nathan Hale. So it's the ultimate full
payback.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating because all of these people, you know, it's not just about the people, though. It's sort of, there's a map on page 173 that's the route of George Washington's Culper Ring. And, you know, if I said to you, hey, I'm going to drive out to Long Island today, I don't know, it's like 2 hours in the car, like we bitch about
it's
that.
It's an hour and a half.
What these guys did, the amount of what they had to do to get information, there's four steps in this map. You really have to see it in the book. But number one, Robert Townsend and James Rivington gathered information in Manhattan. Two, Austin Rowe, Everwood Hall received the intelligence in Manhattan and made the journey to Setauket, where they met, which is outside of the city. Brewster and his men moved across the Sound between and around the British ships to Connecticut, where they handed off the letters to Benjamin Talmadge. Talmadge then carried the information on Washington. That took 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And that was a regular routine.
And you
got to
think, how good is the intelligence is 2 weeks old? So you got to catch good stuff. And Washington sometimes would write back, blows. My words, not his. Not good, not helpful, get it together. So wait, Washington should be thankful, right? He also knew he had to get more out of people.
Right.
So he had to, like, be a little Vince Lombardi, a little Newt Rockne.
Right.
You could do it. Hey, listen, I know it's tough. And I knew you could tell he's in awe of Robert Townsend. He is like, who is this guy?
Why?
This guy, because he was in the city, giving him this intelligence. He goes, he said something similar to the effect of, there's nothing I could ever pay you that would be equal to what you've done for us.
Wow.
By the way, they never took a dime. They just wanted their expenses covered.
See, but how do they, so they have to make an assessment. Okay, this is going to be, this information that I'm about to send off to the General Washington is going to be at least fresh for 2 weeks. In other words, if you have to factor in 2 weeks of time to get it to him, they have to make an assessment. This is information is not going to be any good after, like, you know.
Yeah.
And how do you make that assessment?
Well, you just do the best. I mean, you do the best you can. But by the way, everything else moves slow. You know, you got to write a letter to the British to find out, hey, how long do I have to stay here? You don't get a letter back for 2 or 3 weeks anyway.
Right.
So everything's slower.
Right.
You know, except for they did have Twitter. and that was interesting. I did not know that.
Twitter blew up.
That whole last chapter, they made me cut it out because we're getting a little long.
But there's just the map alone is fascinating, the route that they travel and the hundreds of miles and, you know, the going over river, going over land. I just think that, you know, I see this as a movie. I mean, are you inspired by Turn on AMC and, like, you know?
Actually, I feel as though the timing's not good for me, is that book was written a long time ago, and it's a CV series. They're using the actual characters, but I don't think they're being true to a lot of these characters. And if you're doing a TV series, why would you do a movie? And, hey, are you guys related to that? So we have a lot of explaining to do with would-be movie producers and financiers.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I am a little bit hostage to their ratings. If they rate high, they'll probably do a movie with them. If they rate low, why would I do a movie if it's not going to be successful on cable?
Yeah.
And if they do okay, I got to convince people, which is probably my best scenario, that I could do it better. Because, number one, this book sold a lot better than their book, which is Alexander Rose's book, which is a great book, and it's very detailed. And this series is not detailed. It makes me want to make sure that I have say in the final product.
Yeah.
Not overriding say. If you have to make it a bar, not a coffee shop, I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you got to make Abraham Woodhull do stuff that's clearly not his character,
yeah,
it's
exactly
a problem.
Yeah, that gets back to what I was saying at the top. This is such a it could be such a great movie or a TV series because the characters, some of them are so unexpected in terms of being involved in this. I understand it's for the freedom of a country, but still, like, there are some people I would never have pictured that guy being a spy or that guy helping the spy ring. It's just great.
But this way, America likes it because they see themselves in these spies. We can't see ourselves in Washington. I know I can, because he's one of these guys come over in five generations. And how did I know that? Because even during his lifetime, Europe was in awe of him. The best sculptors and painters begged to do his portrait. So it's not us hyping this guy up.
Yeah.
France loved him. Spain loved him.
Why?
Britain was in awe.
What was it?
Britain
was
wrote him as their number one adversary over Hitler.
What was his? What's it? Was
the
it,
guy they couldn't defeat. And they beat Hitler.
Was it his acumen as a general in
his
warfare?
His ability to lead, his ability to adapt, its ability to be successful, and this thing. He abdicated power twice. As a general, He could have became ruler. Everybody did. He left. He became president, and he left again.
Yeah.
He screwed it up for everybody.
he had a conscience and was true to his moral compass.
Yeah.
Very quickly before we go, talk about the lady in the book, because I'm fascinated, and I think I'm fascinated because I want to know who she could possibly be.
My image is Jennifer Lawrence. And when I saw, before Jennifer Lawrence, I'm not big into who's hot in Hollywood, and I could pick up a magazine of Hollywood magazine and probably not know anyone.
Right.
But I go, when I saw her in what movie? Well, I guess it was...
American Hustle?
Keep going. The one prior to that she won an award for.
Oh.
It was raw, and she was rugged. And
Silver Lining Playbook?
Yeah, Silver Lining Playbook. It reminded me of what I thought Jodie Foster or Tatum O'Neill was going to... Tatum O'Neill.
Oh, okay.
Remember how she was kind of rugged but pretty as a kid?
Yeah.
And then she would grow up as a teenager and marry John McEnroe and would all go south. but, you know, we couldn't
put... And you were stalking her at the time.
Right, and we couldn't put McEnroe in the book. It just wouldn't make sense to talk about Wimbledon.
But who do you think the lady could be in real life?
Oh, in real life, I believe that she was somebody who believed in the cause, that might have had loyalist, aristocratic background.
A legitimate part of the spy ring.
A legitimate part of the spy ring. And had to convince Robert Townsend to let her go. And her entrance onto it is Woodhull's letter to Townsend saying, I have someone who's going to be, in my word, is extreme help to us. You will say benefit to us in the ring. And the spy ring. And she was able to somehow flow freely through social circles beyond suspicion by her presence.
Well, it makes sense. You'd need to have... See, women are good for something. That's worth 8 cents an hour.
The parties. They got to go to the parties.
You get 8 cents.
Yeah, 91 cents of every dollar. We're going to have a protest to win an election on that. Let's not give the Senate to the Republicans. There's a woman making 91 cents instead of a dollar.
That's why...
It's full circle.
This is why...
It's a Seinfeld episode.
Listen, this is the book. It's George Washington's Secret Six. You must go out and buy it, and people can get it signed by you.
Yeah,
right?
If you go to BrianKilmeade.com, it goes to a local bookstore. I don't care where part of the country or what country you're in. You can just personalize it, happy birthday, this or that, or I watch you every day, whatever you want. It goes out to you.
So if I send you a note like, please say that, Paul, you're a very handsome man, you would sign that?
I would sign that as long as the check cleared. As soon as I know it cleared.
And Fox and Friends every morning on Fox News, Kilmeade and Friends every afternoon. From
9 to noon,
sorry, every morning on the Fox News Radio Network. You're
the
best.
And soon to go on the road with you.
Soon to go on the road. And cufflinks and ties are on the way. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Paul. Great job.
All right, so that was my buddy Brian Kilmeade. Really good conversation with him. Really enjoyed it. The book's great. You really should check it out. It's if it doesn't become a movie, I'll be surprised, especially given the turns on the air now and other, you know, Revolutionary War based stories have been turned into movies and TV shows. And I think I'm going to get some cufflinks out of this appearance. So I'm going to keep having him on until he fully clothes me right down to the underwear. All right, check me out doing stand-up April 26th, this Saturday, Bridge Street Live Theater in Collinsville, Connecticut. Always have a great time there. May 1st through the 3rd, Comedy Castle, Royal Oak, Michigan, just outside of Detroit. Really beautiful club. And May 15th to the 17th, my hometown, Gotham Comedy Club, New York City. Awesome club. Love it there. And May 29th to the 31st, I'm going to go get warm and shoot, play some golf at in West Palm Beach. I'm going to be at the Improv in West Palm Beach, Florida. And follow me on Facebook and Twitter, Paul Mercurio. Thanks for checking out the podcast, people.
We take over one borough at a time. Secure our territory. Secure our turf. Because it's all...